Today is Thursday, October 13th, 2022. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan's name is spelled A-L-L-E-N, M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing fine.
Great. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, last time you gave us a pretty wonderful recounting of your service in the Army in Alaska in 1964-65, and you mentioned you were discharged in January of 1966. What do you remember about your trip home?
Okay. Before we get into that, I'd like to comment on one from last time before I, really forget about it.
Okay.
And it has to do with describing how I, came to get a whole series of 8x10 pictures in the Western Grand Canyon that was basically an unknown area, and we talked about one of them that was, and I sent a copy by email to you so we could talk about it.
Yes, it was beautiful and, photo.
And the it's was published by the Sierra Club Bulletin on the cover of their March 68 Sierra Club Bulletin, and there's an article inside that I wrote on hiking the Western Grand Canyon. But I wanted to share my thoughts on a couple things that have come up to me thinking about this, because you had responded to that picture very differently than I did, and that's great. I just hadn't really talked to people about it in that way, and the thing to me, this picture of the canyon, and it has the Colorado River, and there's a 224-mile rapid there, and the trail, the hiking around the inner gorge going upstream from Diamond Creek. And my response, and why, of course, the composition and the lighting was perfect, and it really shows the canyon in the western area very well. But to me, it was a very welcoming picture. When I look at it today, I look in the background there, and I know that I had looked at maps over and over and over and figured detailed, could I hike up the Colorado on the south side? And I figured at the time that I could go maybe 10, 15 miles up there, several days of hiking and side canyons and just what I enjoyed the most. And unfortunately, I was kind of not on a real, well, I wasn't on a real schedule, but it was hot down there, and I was had other areas I wanted to see that summer, and had taken the picture there, which is a few miles upstream from Diamond Creek, and come out and gone on with my trip, which was fine. But when you looked at this, you looked at the river, and you saw the beaches, you saw the sand, you saw the no tamarisk, there was a few mesquite trees there, and you were looking at it from a river runner's point of view, and of course you've hiked huge amounts of the canyon also, but to me at the time, I always joked that the river was in my way. The river was a problem. I never got across the river. I had this trip where I was on the south side of the river, always wishing that I could get across and explore some of the canyons on the north side. And then I came back after the Army and went to the north side and started exploring all the canyons there. And again, the Colorado was in my way and an obstacle more than anything, which was not, you know, I joked about it. But the thing is, with this picture, it says a lot about what was happening there, because, you know, I was there as a photographer, and this was an interesting area because I was, could really, I'd say, pretend to be exploring unknown country, because I was, but I wasn't. This had been explorers, miners, thousands of miners, cowboys, cattlemen, and then recently the people that were going to build the dams. And I was aware of the conservation battle that was just brewing about saving the Grand Canyon. And somehow the Sierra Club was trying to come to terms with how can they get enough support to prevent the Los Angeles Power Company or whoever it was to build a series of dams in the Western Grand Canyon. And I knew that that was happening, and I went in there and felt good about not, you know, my point was just this is great country to hike and backpack and explore and spend time in, and there were beautiful sites. There were, lots of really beautiful views that were worth walking to. The side canyons were so beautiful, and the streams and the true, true wilderness down in there. And also kind of presenting it in a way that it wasn't this, you know, walked through the Western Grand Canyon and lived to tell about it. It was trying to change that attitude that this could be a great place to go. But this was late spring, early summer, probably, and I can't put down the date, which would have been great, that I took that picture. I had detailed logs, and those just didn't survive the last 60 years. I'm surprised that the negatives, I still have that negative. Because I was there, like I say, in April or May. The only thing I can say is after this, I went to Wupakti and actually went to the 4th of July powwow in Flagstaff and spent 3 days there. So that's a date that all these pictures were done before the 4th of July.
Okay.
Which would have been, you know, June, May. I think it's more like May when I think of what I did. Because the point I wanted to discuss in this long, rambling preview is that I really had no interest, no feeling about Glen Canyon and the dam being built. I knew it was being built. I knew the friends that it was making and were meeting and discussing things in northern Arizona. They all kind of said, well, there's a new road up there and a new town, and they're building the dam, and don't bother going through there because it's a zoo. There's trucks and equipment and building, and it's a lot going on, people from everywhere, and it was just not a pleasant way. If you want to get up to southern Utah, go through Jacob Lake and Fredonia and Kanab on the old road. Don't bother the new road. And and it comes back to the couple years later, what the David Brower did that was so important was publish the big picture book, The Land That No One Knew. You know, and I don't know if that's the exact title. I should go look because I got a copy. What is it? The Canyon? But it was about Glen Canyon and how much was lost there. But that's coming in several years. And at the time, it literally was. Glen Canyon was the place that no one knew. I didn't know about it. There were a few people that were, you know, jumping up and down and screaming and saying, you know, this is horrible, but it wasn't getting through to anyone. And it definitely didn't get through to me. And in later years, and it's ironic that I ended up, we spent, you know, 30 years there living in Page and working at Glen Canyon, knew the lake and all the hiking around very actively. But the point was, when I was down there in the Western Grand Canyon, Glen Canyon Dam was being built. And I looked up the other day that the Bureau of Reclamation, when they closed off the bottom of the dam to start tilling Lake Powell, they called it, quote, the start of storage date, was 13 March 1963. And that's just a couple weeks before the picture here. And in reality, this picture of mine shows the canyon before Glen Canyon Dam, which has such a profound effect on the river.
That's right.
With the higher waters, the lower waters, the clear water, the cool water, everywhere you look at it, the canyon that's there now has nothing to do with what it sees here. And it, you know, I had, as best I can do, is that this picture was maybe 6 weeks after the dam was, they started storage. And I know up there, because I did lots of research on the dam and the history of it for various reasons. And when they started construction, they dug two huge tunnels on either side of the river into the cliff that made a big loop around the dam site, and then they built two coffer dams above and below the dam site, and so the river coming down met this coffer dam and then was diverted on the two sides going around the dam site and then went on downstream for the whole time they were building the dam. So the river wasn't, there was a minor disruption there, but people couldn't go up and river runners couldn't. But and then what they, you know, long before they finished the dam, the top of the dam was still under construction when they closed off those diversion tunnels.
Right.
And because, you know, and they filled up the upstream end of those with tunnels with concrete because they had to then drill the tunnels that came almost straight up in the wall, cliff wall on either side, and opened into what became the overflow for the dam, the spillway.
Mm-hmm.
So when the water got, when the dam got full, it spilled over the spillways on either side, went down these tunnels, made a sharp turn, and came out to the river. And it was kind of tricky timing because they wanted the, well, they had to have the spillways built before the lake filled up. Fortunately, it took 18 years to fill the lake, and that's another story.
You know what? But, you know what, Alan? Let's go back to your photo for a minute. I've got some comments on that I'd like to ask you about, and then let's go back to our interview. When you end up moving to Page and studying the dam, that will be a real good time to talk about the dam, I think.
Yeah, well,
but trying to tie it into 1963,
right.
There's a number
let
of
me,
things. Yeah.
Yeah, Tom, let me just, I want to add a couple more sentences, which what I said was this whole previous thing for really a silly comment, but it was very, it's appropriate to what we're talking about here. When the, on 13 March 63, when they closed the diversion tunnels, there was either a misunderstanding or not really target planning in the consequences, because downstream from the dam, the river quit. It was dry. And there's two friends of mine, Dr. Gregory Crampton and P.T. Riley, who wrote, both of them wrote histories of the whole area,
right,
the Grand Canyon and all of that. They were out there at the time in the area, and they got in the car and raced down to Lee's Ferry. And the two of them were amazed at how there wasn't any water coming down the river. And they literally walked across the Colorado River at Lee's Ferry and didn't, the water came above their knees, but not even waist deep, and explored the old historic trail on the other side and walked back. And somehow they put up the alarm and several others to say, you know, wait a minute, we've got to get a normal flow coming down the river here. You're not going to get away with just closing off the dam complete 100% and leaving the Grand Canyon dry. And whoever the powers would be agreed, and they opened some of the tubes that do allow water to come straight through, not going through the generators. And so what we're looking at in that picture is what the compromise had come up with as to how much water the dam should allow down the Grand Canyon, which to me is kind of a preposterous situation. But all of this was going on, and I didn't have a clue up there. And I don't, none of my friends who were conservationists, hikers, everything, they were really weren't aware of what was happening. They definitely didn't know anything about Glen Canyon, and I didn't. The next week when I went around and hiked into Rainbow Bridge, I was so amazed when two guys walked up Forbidding Canyon and said they had taken their boat from downstream up to the mouth of Forbidding Canyon.
Right.
And then I could say, oh my, something's happened here.
It's funny, you know, you and I had talked earlier, and I had just mailed you a thumb drive with the Rainbow Bridge Register on it. That register was really helpful to teach me that the title, The Place No One Knew, in the book by Elliot Porter that the club put together, is not correct. That register shows a lot of people knew about Rainbow Bridge, and it shows that a lot of people knew about Glen Canyon.
Right.
What they, you know, a lot of people didn't know, a lot of hikers, certainly your generation coming up didn't know Glen, but a lot of people did, and so, you know, we can, I can talk for a long time, but I won't, about, you know, that history of who knew about Glen and why they couldn't
right.
do a thing about it. And Park Service did a huge study of Glen Canyon area in the 1930s to make it a national monument and failed, fighting
yeah.
Bureau of Reclamation. But going back to your photo,
yeah.
when I look at your photo, I think about the indigenous peoples that saw that view for thousands of years.
Right.
And knew that country in and out, and knew how to swim, and knew how to boat, and knew how to get across the river. We would be careful to not forget them. Your picture shows me that. Your picture also shows me the biology and the geology of the river and the surrounding country, the sand, the lack of vegetation, the flows. So your photos are so important because they show us that.
Right.
The dam was coming along. That was a low flow for March. You would have expected twice that flow or three times. Certainly
yeah.
not the peak of spring runoff, but getting toward that.
Right.
But it wasn't there. So yeah, you're exactly right. What you caught at that point in time. Is very important. So I want you to hold that thought and keep that, keep thinking about that, because all your pictures of Western Grand Canyon at that time are very important for what they show.
And I like your comment that in Glen Canyon, it wasn't the place no one knew, because a lot of people knew about it. And the same goes for the Western Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
A lot of people knew about it. And, you know, at Diamond Creek, there was originally a hotel down there.
That's right. That's right.
At the river. So, you know, it was gone, not a hint of it, but when I got there, the only reason I was able to go around where I did was because of the people who came before me. And it was the cattlemen and the Native Americans completely. Someday, well, I don't know when to discuss it, but it's something that about the Paiutes. Of course, I'd lived at Pipe Springs is right in the middle of the Paiute Reservation. I knew many of them, and I was out on the exploring the Grand Canyon with some of them. But the point that I, in later years, found out that the interconnection of the tribes, you know, there are bands of Paiutes, the
right.
Kaibab band, the St. George band, all those that were small family, well, extended family groups, the nomadic, very well attuned to living off that land
mm-hmm.
and having been there for centuries. And they had connections across the canyon.
Right.
You know, they readily went back and forth, which got, you know, I found very positive that, you know, if they can do it, I can do it.
That's right.
And if the same with the early cattlemen, like the Bundys out there, have real stories of going from Bundyville on the north side of the river and riding horses down and crossing the river and going up on the other side and working in what is the town out there, Kingman
or Peach Springs,
and then
Truxton.
And then going back, you know, across the wilderness, and it just, and for me, I wasn't discovering new routes and new lands. It was rediscovering what other people had done.
Right.
And that's
right.
That's the neat part. So
yeah.
Okay. Let's get back to our interview.
Yeah, very, very good. Let's go back to January of 1966. You've been discharged from the Army. You're in Alaska. Where did you go then?
I went back to the family home in Los Altos Hills in California. And I kind of got my 8x10 view camera out of mothballs, so to speak, and started figuring out what I was going to do and how I was going to do it, mainly where to go. And I had saved enough money in the from the Army that I definitely had a full season worth of travel that I could enjoy. And I ended up, the first thing I had been been writing back and forth with Terry Gustafson, who you know, and he was now a backcountry ranger at Kings Canyon National Park. And I just on a whim said, well, can I come over there and I spend a week with you guys? His wife, Rosalind, and his son, they had had a little boy, and just explore the Sequoia low country, really, because it was still snowed in up on top. And I went over there and I did just that, explored, took some pictures, just got used to making sure everything functioned. And there they were not having a very good time of it, and I won't get into that, but they ended up separating. And I then came back and did the processing back in California, and then I got ready and went to the north side of the Colorado, and I ended up at Pipe Springs. I camped there because there was a campground at the time. I think I told you before, this was and there was just a dirt road through Pipe Springs National Monument. The road went right next to the fort, and big semi-trucks would go rumbling through right next to the fort. And and later that fall, the state finished the paved road from Colorado City to Fredonia, and it was maybe half a mile south of the monument, which was good because the monument could kind of recuperate from all the trucks and everything and traffic. And
right. Hey, Alan, I want to back up just a little bit here. So it sounds like when you were discharged in January of 66, that you really hadn't given much thought about what to do next. Is that right?
Well,
or you know, you must have been thinking about it. What were you thinking? Did you want to go back to school? I mean,
no, I definitely wanted to continue photographing.
Okay.
I think it was for pretty definite, and I just, you know, the unknowns were, was Terry available? What could happen there? Did I where did I want to go? And I don't know, even talking with him, but I had made the plan, and I think I knew pretty much what I wanted to do, to go to the north side of the Grand Canyon.
And why did you want to go to the north side of Grand Canyon, and not only the north side, but to the west end, which is not the typical, in quotes, North Rim Lodge, the eastern half of the canyon, the high trees, that country. What attracted you to the west end?
It was just I felt like I was comfortable. I was going home again. Here was just continuing what I had done on the south side.
Okay.
And just to, see, the same questions as before. Can I make it? What are the, there trails, water? How difficult is it? It was, Pipe Springs was a national monument, and they had a campground, so that's where I started. And I knew from there you could go down to Grand Canyon National Monument then, a two-week, and Toraweep Overlook, and there was access there, even though it was kind of rough and a long way, but there was a ranger station out there, and it just looked like the place to start.
Okay. And did you still have your Ford Fairlane?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. And I, out in the monument there were some horrendous roads that I drove it all over.
Oh, my.
And the thing that happened, I still had the 8x10, because one of the first trips I did was about a week backpacking down Kanab Creek, Kanab Canyon, to the river and back. And I asked the guys, the guys that worked at the monument, the maintenance, especially the two maintenance guys, they were old cattlemen and themselves, and they knew all about that country, and they directed me to which dirt roads to take, where there were trails, and I went out and off Hack Canyon, and it was a good, 20 miles to the river from there. It's a long way.
So, Alan, hang on a second. I'm going to jump in again. Yeah. The Hack Canyon, that's H-A-C-K, the Hack Canyon Road, there was a uranium mine in there.
Right.
When you were in there, was the mine in operation?
No.
Okay.
It was there. It was on the map. the old dirt road to the mine. The mine was basically in the right next to the little Hack Canyon there, and the road came in from the two-week road down the canyon, and that had washed out several times. The mine was not operating.
Okay.
And what I found out was that there was a horse trail about 5 miles down Hack Canyon from the mine, and there was an easy drive out on the rim right there, and it was almost at the point where Hack Canyon and Kanab Canyon came together, maybe 2 miles from there. And so they all recommended that I could drive all the way out there. Trail down was no problem, and then hike down the canyon either on the sides of the creek, or there were horse trails and cattle trails some places on the way down.
So this is the road system that goes out on the north side of Hack Canyon going east. And then you kind of get pinched out with Kanab Canyon due east of you and Hack Canyon just to your south, and then you get on the Stock Trail and go down into Hack, exactly. Right into Kanab. Got it.
Yeah. And a key to it was right where the trail came down, there was a spring and a big watering trough.
Okay.
And that turned out to be one of the key points of what I ended up, how I went around there. But I went down there. The other thing, why I picked that was John Wesley Powell. And he, on his, especially second trip, well, I might get them all mixed up, but anyway, the photographer on that trip took an 8x10 picture of what he called Scotty's Tower near, in Kanab Canyon.
Right.
And I thought that was neat. And, of course, they were hauled out there the second trip. And the photographer there was a little more involved because he had wet plate negatives that he made. He had to set up a darkroom tent, spread the liquid negative materials on the plate of glass, take it out and put it in the camera, expose it, take it back in the darkroom tent and develop it. And then if it had to somehow pack that to where it could be packed on a pack mule up out of the Grand Canyon. And to me, that made me feel like, well, I really had it made. I had a sheet of negative material that several of the steps that he worried about and that could and did go wrong constantly for them, I didn't have to face. I just had to haul it down there. But I got a lot of good pictures going up and down there and basically learned that I really loved those canyons, and I could see that there was a lot of work there. And then two very major events, and I don't know the exact dates and all, but in the end they were the most important. I bought a VW bus, an old used one, what became known as a hippie bus, but I certainly wasn't hippie, and it was before that time. And I drove that all over the backcountry there on what are now Jeep four-wheel drive roads. And I had a pick and shovel, and I would come up to a place on this old Jeep road, and there'd been a washout, and I would just go out and spend an hour dumping rocks in the hole and digging sand and rebuilding the road for 10 feet and driving across it with my VW. I had a camper in the back, a bunk that I could sleep on. I had the Coleman stove and place for my food and water and whatever. But and the other thing that was major was that I bought a 4x5 view camera. And that changed my operation completely. I could go a lot further. It was a lot longer, more comfortable, take more pictures every day. And
can you explain that to me a little bit? 8x10, the 4x5 is half that size.
1/4 of it, really.
1/4, okay. Oh.
You have four 4x5s can fit on. If you cut an 8x10 in fourths, you've got 4x5s.
Got it. I see.
Which is where the size came from.
Okay. Yeah, so it's 25%. It's a fourth, as you say. And then Why is it different with regards to film? And
the film was cheaper, obviously.
Okay.
The main thing was that I could carry more film. They actually sold a little, kind of like a little box that fit on the back of a camera, about maybe 5 by 7 by 2 inches. And it was a really neat mechanical gadget that I could, I had to take the sheets of film in a dark room or in a dark tent, or they even had changing bags with a, you could do it on your lap out of the sun, but there were five, and then I eventually got to one that had 10 kind of metal sleeves that you would slide the negative into, and then these were stacked in this box, and you put the box on the back of the camera, and you'd pull out the slides so that the one sheet of film there, the one negative, was facing the lens to take a picture. But then you took your picture, closed off put the slide back in to close off the back end light tight.
Okay.
And then there was a way of pushing a button and pulling the one part of it out, and the picture you just took popped to the back.
Oh, wow.
And you put the others all in, and there was a new negative. So, compared to what I had before, this was magic. And I could have at least 5, and if not 10, sheets of film. And I could take those out and in the field, take them out and stack them up in a light, a dark box, and put in another set of negatives.
So instead of 3 pictures a day, you were now up to 20 or more.
Yeah, it was.
Wow.
It was 4. I always had 2 film holders for the 8x10, that each of them had 2 negatives, one faced one way and one the other way. And so I had a maximum of 4 per day.
Okay.
And with the 4x5 like this, it was, and they're still used. I think, I'm pretty sure Gary Ladd, took all his 4x5 transparencies, because that's all he took commercially for his first 20 years.
That's right.
He had boxes like that on the back of the camera. And can I make a quick digression?
Sure.
Maybe I shouldn't say this now, but on Facebook, I knew Gary Ladd had a Facebook page, but he's rarely used it. And when he contacted me and told me about your project, we then went back to his Facebook page. And I don't know if you're aware, but the last month he has posted probably 6 really good pictures, and they are 35 millimeter.
Yes.
Of these crazy guys hiking in the Grand Canyon. And they're all places that are impossible. There's a huge cliff face, and you see this little guy moving across it, with the pack on. And it happens, usually your name is on the caption who is out there. And I don't know if he did it on purpose, I haven't asked him, or if he's just into a place where he's found a bunch of these old pictures that are very popular, guys exploring the canyon in the rock climbing and the very difficult places that look horrendous if you get it in the right perspective. But he's, if you want some entertainment, you can find his Facebook page, and you're there in all your glory.
Well, you're very kind. Yeah, I'll tell you about the history of those photos once we're done here. So,
yes.
Yeah. So I did have another question for you. You mentioned when we first started that you had met Ansel Adams and had taken some classes with him. Is that about to happen? Is that coming up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Great. All right, so hold that thought. I'm there.
Right, it's coming.
And then
remind me, though, because there's so much going on.
And then, so let's talk about your Kanab trip. Did you have the VW bug or the bus, or were you still in the fare lane on your Kanab trip?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Neither.
Okay.
I think it was the Ford Fairlane.
Okay, which was about to transform into the bus. That makes sense. So talk to me about that Kanab trip. There's water down there. You go through some wonderful narrows. 1966, you come out to the river and then turn around and go back. This was in the spring of 66, if I can figure out the timeline. So no monsoon
I'll
troubles.
I'll tell you what the reality of it was, that I hiked down in the lower canyon. It just gets more and more spectacular and more, and I come around a corner, and there's the river, and I just said, oh, shoot, this is the end. There's no more Kanab Canyon.
Hmm.
I got that darn river. I got to go back.
Did you run out of film?
No.
Okay.
I think I took enough, because, see, I could carry boxes of negatives, several boxes that were a lot lighter than the couple 8x10 negatives.
So. Okay.
But the first time I went down, I had the 8x10. Came out with several good pictures, including one of Scotty's Tower that I kind of mimicked the... And who was the photographer? I'm embarrassed now.
I want to say Beeman, but I'm not sure.
I don't think so.
Okay.
It was the second trip they came out in Kanab Canyon.
Yep.
And on horseback, Jacob Hamlin and his sons met them down at the river and packed everything off the boats out Kanab Canyon. But when I was there, the other thing is you could not even consider getting a horse or mule down the canyon. There'd been enough floods that moved these huge house-sized boulders around, and you had to climb over or crawl under, and that was a surprise to me, that because I'd read John Wesley Powell, and you know, there was no way anybody was going to haul anyone up and down the lower end of Kanab Canyon.
And so let me make sure I get this right. On the first Kanab hike, you still had your 8x10?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And I made several more trips down there, 5 or 6.
Okay.
In later years, so we'll do that later. But when I came out next, I went out to Tuweap, Coral Weep Overlook, Grand Canyon Monument, from Pipe Springs, packed up everything and moved my camp to the rim there at Coral Weep. And driving the last couple miles across the Esplanade, really, and that sandstone slick rock was a real challenge in a Ford Fairlane in those days.
Okay.
But I went back and forth. And I would gladly start my discussion and reminiscence of John Riffey.
Let's do that right now. This is good.
I can't think of any trip out there that he didn't impact and that I smile about.
Did you meet meet him on that first drive out there?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yes. He was, you know, the ranger out there by himself. It was all dirt road out there. He was the only person. He had a nice stone house, sort of like it had been built by the CCC, but I don't think so. But he did everything, and, you know, he had a little blader that he bladed the dirt gravel road to try to keep it passable, and he hauled cinders from the cinder cone over there to put on the make kind of a road. So his road construction, his main job was as a park ranger, as a law enforcement. He had been sent there really to keep track of the cattle companies, because the monument had been designated. The cattle permits that had been under the BLM were still valid, but only for the life of the permittee. And the locals, many of them whom I met through Riffey and through the people up at Pipe Springs, because they were all related, they quickly made sure that their permits were in the, I'll take that back. I was going to say they got them to the youngest person possible, but it didn't work. It didn't work in the parks, but there were several of the permits there that the permittees were in their 90s.
Okay.
And often if it was the mother, the matriarch, that was in the 90s, and there were several generations working cattle out there on her permit. And his job, Riffey's job, was to make sure they weren't cheating.
Right.
You know, and when a couple of the permits had reverted to the park, at, you know, real hostility from the cattle people. They didn't hold it against Griffey.
Right.
But the whole concept of it was really, really hard on them, and there's still hostility out there of the losing the grazing permits to the park.
So, Alan, I'm going to back up a minute. What was your first take on John Riffey? What was your first size him up for me? What did he look like? What did he say? What did you think?
Well, he was the nicest guy I ever met. He would do anything for you, and without saying so. He just did. He just felt like, you know, I was... you know, I had misgivings. I was going into unknown country. Unknown, I knew kind of what I wanted to do, but not how to do it. And he was just right there telling, his favorite way was not to tell me what to do out in the wilderness, but to tell me what, oh, there was this, you know, visitor 10 years ago that ended up doing this stupid thing. The implication was, you don't want to do this.
Right, right.
Stupid thing. And the funny stories, hysterical stories. He was, I would say, kind of gangly physically. You know, it wasn't an imposing person, and he wasn't aggressive or, here I am, I'm in charge. His personal thing, which I talked to him about a lot, was the way to deal with the cattlemen and the families is to just be friends with them.
Yeah.
Be part of the community. I understand where they're coming from. Eventually, hope you can tell them where the park's coming from. And he spent a lot of his time helping, of course, visitors, but there were almost no visitors out there. But the local people, because a lot of the old pioneer families, some of them still lived there. There were the Bundys, of course, what's his name? Chuck Bundy was over in Bundyville, but came over into Two Wheat Valley.
Mm-hmm.
There was one of his older brothers, and I can picture him and his wife lived in Two Wheat Valley there. When you drove in there, just before the park boundary and before the airstrip, there were two old frame houses from the 1930s Depression, when all those people came out and settled there and thought they were going to be farming out there.
Hmm.
And, of course, the drought came and they all backed up except the Bundys. And one of those that's now just a collapsed building, that the Bundys were still living in it. And they were elderly. The wife was quite handicapped. And I went with Don Riffey several times when he was taking a tank of water out there, or he had been to town and he got some food for them, whether they wanted it or not. So, and I think I really enjoyed that, and I was very moving to me, and I was pretty glad he took me along, and I think in the long run, he felt a little different about me because I readily went out to those people and related and talked and just, I just had a lot that I could learn from them.
Nice.
And from Riffey.
And this would have been Chet Bundy's, that's Chetbundy, Chet Bundy's mom and dad that came out to originally homestead the area. The 1910s or early 1920s.
Yes. Yeah. And I interacted with that bunch quite a bit over the years.
Unless it was Chet's older brother, because he had
That's what I'm thinking it was.
Okay. Chet had a much older brother. I bet, that would make more sense in the timeline of this. Thank you.
And his older brother, they were from Bundyville area, but had moved over there at Two Weep. And I have an idea John Riffey even moved them or encouraged them because they needed help and they weren't going to go to St. George where all the other Bundys were.
Right.
So... he spent a lot of time with them, and he knew all the other cattlemen. The cattle industry was changing. Some of the permits were being bought up by dentists in Scottsdale, and then leased out to the locals who ran cattle again, but the first trip out there, I got some really good pictures off of Two Weep, and what's the cinder cone called right there? I forgot.
Vulcan's Throne?
Vulcan's Throne, yes. I've got several pictures of that in different angles.
But nice.
I really explored and talking to him and talking to others. Then I got the VW and took several trips here and there out in that country, which I don't really remember. But the next thing I'd like to talk about, and I don't know if it's maybe we should do it next time, but if I the Sierra Club highlight trip leaders, the department, that their Sierra Club outings that I had been on in California a lot.
Right.
One of the guys came out, and I have the remembrance that he looked me up, that he found where I was at Pipe Springs, and I think it was Howard Mitchell. I couldn't think of his name yesterday, and he was the highlight leader, and he wanted to propose a highlight trip down Kanab Canyon for the Sierra Club. And that was really exciting idea to me. And he said, you know, I knew what it involved and what was going to happen, who was going to come and all. And he said he didn't know who to find that could pack the trip. And so I spent a couple of weeks going around to my friends at Pipe Springs in Moccasin, Arizona, the town just north of Pipe Springs, that were all pioneer cattlemen out there.
Mm-hmm.
I got enough guys together that they agreed that, yeah, this would be okay. He was going to pay a couple $100, and they had enough stock that we could, well, they all had pack animals, and they all rode, and they knew where to go, and they'd been down Kanab Canyon, and I kind of set it up, got agreements with this guys, and called Howard Mitchell back and said, yeah, I found them for you. I can organize that if I can go along.
Okay.
And he said, yes, and that was the beginning of a lot of total different direction I went for many, many years. But
okay.
This
is a great place to stop and put a comma in then for the next oral history. We'll ask you about your first pack trip into Kanab.
Trips with Whiffy.
Is there anything else you want to add to the ground we've covered today?
Not yet. I can do it next time.
Okay.
Because after this is when John Riffey really, and I, in cahoots, he really did a lot of work to help me find the old route into the canyon.
Oh, nice. Okay. We'll talk about that. That'll be good.
Yep.
Okay.
Same time next week.
Yeah, with that, let's go ahead and conclude part 5. Of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Thursday, October 13th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Kind of rambling today, but that's okay. There's tidbits of information here and there.
Yep, that's the way it goes. Okay, hang on a minute.
Thank you.